You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Well, good morning. I'm Ted Pacone. I'm a senior fellow and deputy director of the Foreign Policy Program here at Brookings. And it is a real honor for us to be able to welcome Antonio Guterres, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, here to the Brookings Institution. I don't think that he needs much of an introduction, but let me just say a couple of brief words. I first had the opportunity to meet him in the context of another activity that he's been involved in, particularly before he took on this job, which was the Club of Madrid. It's a group of former presidents and prime ministers, and Antonio is one of the leading voices in that esteemed group who really had a vision and a mission and a mandate. And I think he's brought that to everything he's done in politics and now at the UN, at one of the most important jobs on the front lines of helping people who are in really the most dire circumstances cope and resettle their lives. You all know his bio and his background, former prime minister of Portugal for many years, and a leading figure in Portugal's own transition to democracy. You're also familiar with the agency that he heads, and we're going to hear more about it today as UNHCR is celebrating its 60th anniversary at a time of tremendous challenge and growing demands being placed on this agency everywhere from, you know, Pakistan, Iraq, Afghanistan, Somalia, Cote d'Ivoire, Libya. The list goes on and on and on, Colombia in this hemisphere. And yet the resources are falling way short to, you know, huge gaps in meeting the needs. So we're going to hear about what's going on with UNHCR and in this particular moment of demand and crisis, and then we'll have a chance to engage in a lively conversation back and forth, and I think we'll have him speak right here from the chair. Please, let me welcome.
Does this work?
Sure.
It works? Okay, fine. Well, I think it's better to have a more friendly conversation without the podium. I always feel a little bit intimidated with podiums. I'd like to say I'm very happy to be here with you, and I've been following your project on internal displacement, which I think is, to a large extent, in the very center of your concerns. And I think that the Brookings Institute has given a fantastic contribution to the capacity of the international community to think about how to face challenges for which, to be honest, we were not well prepared, and I believe we are still not yet well prepared. The main concern we have today in the run-up for the commemorations of our 60th anniversary of the 51 Convention, the main concern is to try to see if the international community will be willing to consider the need to address the protection gaps in relation to the new forms of forced displacement that we have in today's world. The 51 Convention is a remarkable instrument. I doubt that if it would be drafted today, it would be as strong as it is. The rights that are emphasized the way the international community has given UNHCR a strong mandate in relation to monitor the way those rights are respected by countries, by states. Again, I don't think these would be possible to replicate today. But the 51 Convention addresses a limited number of the people on the move with protection needs in today's world. There has been a lot of developments in the interpretation of what persecution means. Today we recognize lots of non-state agents of persecution. There has been, and courts have given a very important contribution, a very enlarged interpretation, for instance, of the concept of a particular social group as a source of persecution. And we see now that from family violence to the questions of LGBTI and to other cultural, religious aspects, society linked more than even state linked. The convention is being interpreted more and more as allowing for persecution to be invoked in an enlarged, in a broader number of aspects, but even going as far as we can in the interpretation of the convention, we need to recognize that the convention will never cover most of the people that today are in need of protection on the move in the world. First of all, by definition, the convention doesn't cover the people displaced within the borders of any country. And if we have 10.5 million refugees, not counting the Palestinian refugees, under UNHCR's mandate, we have 27.4 or 5 internally displaced people because of conflict, and the number of people internally displaced because of natural disasters changes very quickly, but some estimations go up to 50 million. And they are obviously not covered by the 51 Convention. All these people are under the authority of their own states, and we know that those states are in many circumstances part of the problem and not part of the solution. Sometimes because they are failed states or very weak states, they have not the capacity to protect their own people. Sometimes because they are strong states, and this is the worst situation, and they are not willing to protect their own people, or they are the oppressors of their own people. And we recently had situations as complex as Sri Lanka, or as enduring as Darfur, in which this is very clear. And even in natural disasters, when one sees what happened in Myanmar, it is not always clear that protection is properly granted to people by the states in charge. But then there is more and more people also on the move crossing borders that have protection needs that are not addressed by the international community and that, and for whom it's not possible to invoke the 51 Convention. If one looks at today's global trends or mega trends, population growth, it's an issue that has not been very much in the global agenda. There is, I think, a certain conspiracy to put the population growth question out of the global debate. But I think it is a main driver that we cannot forget. We are today almost 7 billion worldwide. The forecasts for 2050, as you know, are 9 billion. But population growth is linked to another phenomenon that I think is crucial to analyze what's happening in today's world, which is urbanization. We are having more and more urban refugees, less and less refugees in camps, but more than half of the world's population today live in cities, and again, the forecast for 2050 is 70%. This is a total change in relation to traditional patterns, and the protection concerns in an urban environment are very different from the protection concerns in traditional encampment situations or in rural environments. Then, climate change. I must say that, in my opinion, climate change is the biggest frustration for anyone that looks at the international community today, the inability to have a common front to address this problem. And it is clear that climate change has huge direct impacts, and it's an enhancer of the impacts of many other trends in today's world. For instance, water scarcity. 1.5 billion people lack safe water. Food insecurity. 1 billion people is hungry today. And there is a clear linkage. We see lots of summits on climate change, summits on food security, but these things are never brought together. And indeed, what I feel is that all these megatrends are getting more and more interconnected. The world is becoming smaller and smaller. There are today physical limits to global growth. And they not only are more and more interconnected, but they are also connected with concerns of security and of peace. They trigger conflict in many circumstances, or they help trigger conflict. And at the same time, all these factors combined are today a main cause of displacement. And it is very difficult to distinguish when displacement is voluntary and when displacement is forced in these situations. We know, for instance, if there is a tornado, there is a natural disaster that is clear, that has an impact, an immediate impact. But the slow onset of certain aspects triggered by climate change, for instance, drought. drought makes slowly areas being totally inhabitable, not inhabitable. And of course, more and more people will be leaving. At a certain moment, there will be nobody there. Is this economic migration? Is this forced displacement? It is not clear. And what is real is that in today's world, we are having more and more situations in which we have mixed flows of populations on the move. Some might be considered refugees, even according to the 51 Convention. Others are clearly traditional economic migrants. But many are in these blurred circumstances which you do not know exactly why they are moving. And we can say that there are more than patterns of forced displacement that are not fully understood in today's world. And because of that, the capacity of the international community to grant protection to people in need of protection in these new trends of forced displacement is very limited. There are no legal instruments beyond those human rights general instruments that exist, and we know that human rights agenda in general has been losing ground in relation to the national sovereignty agenda in recent past. And at the same time, the coalitions, the forms of cooperation between states, international organizations, in order to address these protection gaps are very limited. And one of the central aspects of the debate we would like to generate going into the ministerial conference that will culminate our commemorations of the 60th anniversary is to try to make the international community accept the need to seriously discuss what kind of new instruments, new forms of cooperation, new alliances are necessary, what kind of new protection compact can be defined in order to address the protection gaps that are due to the new trends of forced displacement in today's world. Knowing that many of these forms of forced displacement are internal, but also that many of them are involve the crossing of borders. And there are many issues on the table. For instance, one of the issues that is very centrally on the table of our discussions today inside UNHCR and with our partners is, does it make sense to try to have a new legal instrument on temporary protection? Is it something that we should be looking at? The European Union as an instrument on temporary protection. Some Nordic countries, for instance, grant temporary protection to victims of natural disaster. But the situation is very different from countries. Is there a chance of an instrument like that to be considered? Probably not. If so, is it a useful instrument? Some people will argue, isn't that going to undermine refugee protection according to the 51 Convention? So there are lots of very interesting discussions that I believe will be very important to have, and the Brookings Institute is very much invited to put your intellectual capacity producing ideas and arguments in favor and against the possible alternatives we have in addressing these protection gaps in today's world. Looking more directly in relation to our challenges now in accordance to our mandate, but also linked to the problems of internal displacement due to conflict, I usually consider that the center of our concerns, independently of many other crises around the world that have a local or a regional impact, the center of our concerns is with what a Time magazine number of I think the 80s had in its front page, what was called an arc of crisis. And the arc of crisis is still the same. It starts in Pakistan, it goes into Afghanistan, Iraq and its neighbors, the Middle East, Palestine and Lebanon, and then it comes down to Sudan, Chad, and to the Horn of Africa, including Yemen in the other side of the Horn of Africa, Somalia, of course, and its neighbors. Two-thirds of the world's refugees are generated in this arc of crisis, and at the same time, this arc of crisis is linking a number of situations that are more and more interconnected. All of them are linked to concerns of global security. Just recently had this operation that was very much in the media, that took place exactly in one of the points of the arc of crisis. To a certain extent, probably the most complex relationship in today's world, the relationship between the so-called Western world and the Muslim world, are very much in the center of this arc of crisis. As I said, two-thirds of the world refugees are generated in this arc of crisis. And even if we have many other operations that are dramatic from the humanitarian point of view, the Democratic Republic of Congo, for instance, and we could go on and on, in the Western Hemisphere, Colombia, recently Sri Lanka was, of course, one of the most acute situations that are out. But each one of those other ones are isolated to a certain extent. They are problems in themselves, or they have a regional dimension, but they are not in the global concerns of the international community. Nobody is expecting that a Congolese terrorist will come out of the DRC to put a bomb in Oslo. But people might think that someone originating from any of the areas of the Arca crisis might one day go to Oslo to put a bomb, or be already in Oslo and do something of this sort. So there is a certain neglect of the international community in relation to the other crises that tend to be forgotten, even if sometimes they have a dramatic humanitarian impact and people suffer enormously. Eastern Congo is a good example of that. But it is fair to say that the essential of our efforts is today concentrated in this arc of crisis. Now, I believe that this arc of crisis that represents a lot of our concerns offers today also a very important opportunity, and I would like to end with these comments. When one sees what recently happened in Tunisia and Egypt, and I know the two situations are not the same. I mean, the Jasmine Revolution is probably more authentic as a revolution than the Lotus Revolution in many aspects. The role of the army, for instance, is different in both countries. But the truth is that for many that thought that in the Arab world there was no alternative but either to support a dictatorship or to support an Islamic fundamentalist movement, it was proven that there was another alternative, and that alternative, at least in the beginning of its development, could be based on, if not fully democratic values, at least clear democratic aspirations. Now, I lived myself a revolution when I was 25 in Portugal. We had, as you know, a right-wing dictatorship linked to a colonialist regime. We could call it a fascist regime, probably it's not exactly an adequate definition. It's an authoritarian, conservative regime, and we had the revolution. But after the revolution, we had 1 year and a half of very dramatic social unrest and political instability, a struggle for power. The communists tried to take over and to establish a new dictatorship in Portugal. This is well known. I think it was Kissinger that once told Mario Soares, "You are the Kerensky of Western Europe." So many thought that Portugal was lost for democracy at the time. So it was a very tough struggle, lots of economic difficulties. And in the end, democracy could prevail for many reasons. I think the Portuguese have some responsibility in that. But there was a massive international support. Political support and international support and economic support. And to be honest, I do not see this kind of support available for Tunisia and for Egypt and for those that in Tunisia and Egypt want to take profit of this occasion to build a true democracy, knowing that in Tunisia and in Egypt, as in Portugal in the 70s, there will be people trying to hijack the revolution and with good chances to win, as they almost did in Portugal. So we cannot neglect that possibility. I see Europe, to be honest, too divided in relation to the situation in Northern Africa. We have seen in Libya Germany against the intervention, France and Britain assuming a very active role. I see the debate in Europe more centered in the questions of closing the borders or the risk of people coming from the south into Europe, more centered in that than centered in the support to democracy and to democracy development In the area. And I also believe that the way the Libyan crisis has developed has created a very important new opportunity when one thinks about the relationship between the Arab world or the Muslim world and the Western world. For those that understand Al Jazeera Arabic, I don't, but I mean, our colleagues that tell me what's happening, they see hour after hour, day after day, Al Jazeera Arabic showing NATO forces as the good guys. And I think this is new, which means that in the Arab world, in the Arab streets, the Western intervention is perceived as a positive thing. And this, I think, is an important element, in the way political actors can maneuver trying to address some of the complex problems of the arc of crisis in all its dimensions. And so my appeal would be for a more concerted effort and probably for a more active American leadership in trying to take profit of these opportunities and trying to use these opportunities not only for the promotion of human rights, refugee protection, and democracy in this region that has been very complex from all these perspectives, but also in taking profit of these opportunities to address some of the peace and security issues that have been unresolved for decades in the area. Our contribution is, of course, very limited, very small, but I think that this represents a set of risks and opportunities. Politicians are sometimes experts in transforming opportunities into problems. I hope that there will be some capacity this time for some political leadership to emerge able to transform some of the problems into opportunities.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much. You've given us a lot to chew on, and I know we have a lot more ground to cover, and this audience will have a lot of good questions, but I want to jump in with some couple of thoughts that were sparked by your comments. In this issue around Tunisia and Egypt and Libya, you're seeing a lot of new flows that we haven't seen before, and what's been so striking is the number of migrant workers from sub-Saharan Africa in Libya who now need help. In today's newspaper, you know, the IOM ship taking people out of Misrata is one very current example. Could you say a little bit more about, number one, that dynamic and to what extent it may upset the democratic transitions in Tunisia and Egypt as the spillover effect of the Libya operation? And also the process in which those migrants are not probably going to return to Libya, and how are they going to get back to their home countries, et cetera?
When at a certain moment there was a massive outflow from Libya into Tunisia and Egypt, but especially into Tunisia, we joined efforts, IOM and UNHCR, and we organized together with a certain number of governments that put a lot of resources at our disposal, a massive humanitarian repatriation operation aiming exactly at these third country nationals that were migrants in Libya and were moving in big numbers. I think it's important to distinguish two groups. Those that had not really big protection problems, that basically were fleeing because of the conflict and wanted to go back home, and we helped them to go back home without many problems, and many of the sub-Saharans that were facing a very dramatic situation inside Libya because there was this idea that as Gaddafi had hired mercenaries from several African countries that they could be targeted inside Libya, and we had some very dramatic appeals for support from people from sub-Saharan Africa. In any case, of the 650,000 people that left Libya until now, it's an amazing number. The overwhelming majority were nationals of third countries, and those nationals of third countries were massively brought back home. And they wanted to go back home. They did not want to go to Europe, contrary to what people think. They want to go back home, and they were helped to go back home. And the numbers now at the border are very small. The problem for Tunisia and for Egypt, and I have to say that they have opened the borders, and the Tunisians in particular were extremely supportive of all kinds of protection concerns in relation to everybody that crossed the border. In Egypt, we had some difficulties, but as a whole, I think these countries have been extremely generous, opening their borders unlimited way. But as I said, this group of people that left has not been a problem for Tunisia and for Egypt. What is a very serious problem, especially for Egypt, but also for Tunisia, is the number of nationals that returned. We believe that there was about 1 million Egyptians in Libya. Probably almost half of them have gone back to Egypt. And as you can imagine, in a country that has a lot of unemployment and that is now facing an economic crisis because tourism came down quite dramatically, to absorb all of a sudden half a million people is a big challenge. Tunisia has a similar problem with a smaller scale, mm-hmm. but this requires, in my opinion, massive support to allow them to be able to cope with this challenge, knowing that both societies have high levels of unemployment and especially of youth unemployment. And youth unemployment, I think there are about 400,000 young unemployed in Tunisia, of which almost half with a university degree. This is potentially a group of population that can be very problematic in a democratic transition. And of course, what's the return from Libya only increases the threats coming from this situation. So this is one of the areas where I believe a positive attitude of international cooperation, namely, eventually, with some migration opportunities, and I'm very sorry to see that when 20-something thousand Tunisians have crossed the Mediterranean into Europe, this has created, I mean, such an outcry. We have 1.7 million Afghan refugees in Pakistan, and at the moment we had about 6 million. Now 20,000 is a little bit less. So it's sometimes difficult to understand how the political debate gets out of proportion with the reality that is behind. But that's life, and we have to live with it. But in any case, this return has been quite problematic for the economies and the societies in Egypt and Tunisia. On the other hand, we have now two groups with clear protection needs. One group is Libyans that are now crossing. And you have witnessed the fighting in the border with Tunisia, in the southern part of the border, and our Berber communities have been forced to move into Tunisia. And this is a serious protection problem, that they cannot go back. And again, Tunisia has been extremely generous in supporting them, but it represents now a refugee protection problem that is serious and that we are trying to address together with other partners. And on the other hand, we have a group of Eritreans and Somalis, essentially, a few Iraqis, a few Palestinians, but essentially Eritreans and Somalis that cannot go back home. And they represent true refugees that are refugees for the second time. They were refugees into Libya, and then they are refugees out of Libya. And and we have appealed for a global solidarity resettlement program for these people, but until now the offers we had are relatively small compared with the number of people that we are now assisting, both at the Tunisian border, there without any difficulties, and at the Egyptian border, fortunately smaller numbers, but with big difficulties in relation to, I mean, conditions to have the authorization to act and to erect the conditions to give a more humane assistance to them. So it's still a very challenging discussion with the Egyptian authorities, the way these people can be assisted. But we have this protection problem that will need to be addressed. In any case, it is also important to understand that Libya is an important client for Tunisia and for Egypt. That client no longer exists. I mean, the Tunisian exports into Libya. Libyans would buy lots of things in Tunisia, they're not buying anymore. So the economic impact of the Libyan crisis in Tunisia and in Egypt is, I think, quite high, and is one reason more for international solidarity. I think that the same solidarity that these two countries have shown to those fleeing Libya should be shown by the international community. That's one of the areas where I believe leadership is necessary, because that solidarity is not happening. It's happening in very small scale.
Well, that's a good way to transition before I take questions to a point you made towards the end of your remarks, which is the question of U.S. leadership. You just spent some time around town on Capitol Hill, and I'm sure you've picked up a rather difficult and political environment here. Both we have a fiscal crisis with a strong political demand for cutting budgets, and then we have a very specific call by certain Republicans who want to cut the budget, the U.S. contribution to the U.N. In dramatic ways. I'm just wondering if you could share with us how you see that problem and ways in which it's being addressed.
Well, I'm not going to give many opinions about budget deficits in the U.S. My own country is, as you know, with a big budget deficit, so I don't think I have much authority with that. But it is clear for me that you will not be solving your budget deficit problems looking at the contributions to international organizations. Or, I mean, I think you have two big questions to solve, which is your tax system and the areas that represent serious entitlements, I would say, especially related to Social Security, to wealth, etc. I mean, it's up for the U.S. to deal with those things, but to think that the budget deficit can be solved without addressing those bulky parts, I mean, is, in my opinion, not very... there is not much you can, even if you cut the entire contribution that the U.S. gives to international organizations and even the entire foreign aid of the U.S., I don't think that will solve the budget problem. I think the budget problem needs to be solved somewhere else. Then there you can decide whatever you decide, but it's not there that the problem can be solved, in my opinion. The question is, if you look at the area, the arc of crisis, the budgetary implications of the arc of crisis in the U.S. are, I don't know how many hundreds of billions or trillions, but the budgetary implications of the arc of crisis in the U.S., look at your operations in Afghanistan, your operations in Iraq, your involvement in Sudan. And Sudan, by the way, things are getting worse. I'm very worried about what might happen in Sudan in 1 or 2 months' time. We looked at the referendum as a big success, but no problem has been solved. RBA was not solved, border questions are not solved, oil resources is not solved, citizenship is not solved. We are witnessing declarations that are more and more, tough from both sides. Recently, Bashir saying that he might not recognize the South if the South would consider RBA in their constitution. So, we have now 12 rebel groups in the South, 12 rebel groups in the South. We have witnessed a lot of military operations in the South, and hundreds of people have been killed. We have witnessed a pile-up of military might, both by the North and by the South, in the RBA area. And so things can get very nasty. And again, this is a very strong involvement for American foreign policy. The impact of Somalia in relation to piracy or in relation to terrorism, we are discussing, in this arc of crisis, we are discussing very strong budgetary involvement for the United States. So whatever can be done, solving problems, to reduce these budgetary involvements will have a much bigger impact in the budget than what might be spent in support of international organizations or of countries of the region that have a chance to become true democracies. So I think that an active leadership, which is, in my opinion, more needed in the political dimension than in the economic dimension, but that has obviously economic implications. An active leadership in relation to Tunisia and Egypt as potential, hopeful democracies, and Libya in the solution of the conflict, can have an impact that in the medium term will help substantially solve the budgetary problems of the United States. So I would argue in favor of an investment in these questions that I believe has a potential very positive future budgetary implication. Because when one compares the amounts, I mean, we are dealing with two completely different worlds, no? I mean, any military operation has a cost that has nothing to do with development cooperation or humanitarian, much less with humanitarian aid. Humanitarian aid is just a drop in the bucket in relation to the real budgetary problems the U.S. is facing.
Right. Thank you. That's very helpful. All right, let's take some questions. We have someone with a microphone going around. If you could introduce yourself and try to keep your comments generally brief so that we can get as many people as possible. And if you don't mind, maybe we'll take two or three just in light of the time. I have someone right here in the front row whose hand was up first.
My name is Tariq Ben Youssef. I'm the Deputy Chief of Mission of the Embassy of Tunisia. I want to thank you, Honorable Prime Minister, and
I did not know.
Prime Minister and Honorable High Commissioner, for your leadership and the role of your organization in addressing the daunting challenge of refugees in Tunisia. And you have highlighted the role that Tunisia is playing. And I think you are the best messenger today in Washington to convey this message. I want to push back the same question. What was the response at the level of the Hill, the Congress? You have seen Republican, Democrats towards an expeditious and urgent package of assistance to Tunisia, which represents a momentous opportunity for the United States and the international community, which will have a diffusion and multiplier effect if this democratic transition will succeed. And how do you explain the slowness in response? We haven't seen yet this evidence of sympathy and love from the international community translated in concrete assistance, especially economic. And you have eloquently highlighted the urgency of addressing in the short term for the young people, graduate people, which are more than 160,000 in Tunisia. And the Tunisian interim government has the urgency to create and the condition for these elections, which are taking place on the 24th of July, which will be the first credible and democratic election. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Let's take just a couple more before we come back. Over here, please.
Okay. Yeah. Recently, a couple hundred Yemeni Jews were brought in.
Can you introduce yourself, please?
I'm sorry?
Can you introduce
yourself? Oh, Jim McDonald, Alexandria, Virginia. Recently, several hundred Yemeni Jews were brought into the U.S. fraudulently under refugee programs. And, you know, I don't know if the U.N. High Commission has any role in that or feels like they were a victim of that, you know, as it affects credibility. I would be interested in that. And then, if so, has the High Commission doing something to control the, quote, offending refugee service?
Thank you. And this gentleman, the pink shirt in the middle here?
Yes, hi, Jesse Bernstein, Human Rights First. Thank you, High Commissioner, for your presentation and your time today. One question I wanted to ask you in relation to resettlement. I think you're probably aware that one of the primary concerns of the advocacy community here in the United States and in Washington is the delays in the security checks for refugees who are coming into the U.S. via the resettlement program. And I think as Americans, we all urge and want effective and thorough security checks, but many of us are concerned about the delays and the negative impact on refugee protection. And I wonder if there's anything you can say on this point following your discussions with U.S. officials here in Washington and any perspectives that you have on how the situation can be resolved.
Well, first of all, to be absolutely frank, I think that there is not yet in Europe and there is not yet in North America a clear understanding of what really, in my opinion, is at stake in the Lotus and the Jasmine revolutions. And I'm afraid that there is not yet a clear understanding of how important it is to guarantee the success of a democratic experience in these two countries from the point of view of the democratic values in themselves, but also from the point of view of the region and from the point of view of global peace and security. I don't think we are there. And I think that all of us need to make more efforts to convince people about the urgency. I fully agree with the urgency and the need. And again, it's not much. I mean, Egypt is probably more complex than Tunisia in relation to this, but Tunisia to address the problem, I mean, it's not much compared with the possibilities that, in my opinion, are available to the major international players. Resettlement is for us a very important priority. Vincent Costel, who's now our representative in Washington, has been the director of the resettlement service that was created to both boost our capacity and improve the quality of resettlement referrals. We have doubled the capacity in the last few years, and we have made an enormous effort to improve the quality of resettlement, exactly to avoid fraud situations. Now, the U.S. has an important part of the resettlement program into the U.S. through UNHCR referrals, but there are other projects that the U.S. That U.S. develops. I don't know the case that you referred, but I've never heard about it in the UNHCR. I don't think this group was through UNHCR, but I mean, we could check, because there are other other projects that are being developed without our info, even if our referrals represent probably today 80% or something of the sort of the resettlement opportunities. There are risks of fraud. I mean, in family reunification, there was a very serious problem in relation to Somalis. There are risks of fraud. We are actively engaged in trying to address those risks of fraud. There are risks of security. We have now the active cooperation of a friendly government that is represented in this room in relation to with people, expert people in relation to security issues in our RSD and resettlement mechanisms. So, I mean, we are very much concerned to make sure of that there is quality in the referrals. But in relation to resettlement, yesterday in our meeting in DHS, we have, I would say, a very open dialogue with the Department of Homeland Security. Yes, in my talking points, there were 31 issues. So you can imagine how many things are being discussed, from detention to unaccompanied minors to the material support bar and related things, to the situation of Asians, to the changes in the regulations about in the refugee approach, or statelessness. I mean, so we discussed lots of things, but I would say 1/3 of the time was with the talking point referring to the situation you mentioned. There are two areas, one area which is related to DHS regulations and one area that is also in PRM's part, and I think the two entities are working together very strongly with our cooperation in order to try to address the problem. The problem became very acute in the first quarter of this year because only 200 and something, 270 or whatever, admissions were possible during this period, but there is a very clear understanding of the problem and a very clear commitment to address and solve the problem. So that's what I can tell you, and the discussion was extremely, extremely positive. We also have advocated for a certain number of other, I mean, we would like to see the laws changed, but that is something I understand is probably not exactly easy in the present context in the U.S., but at least there are some regulatory mechanisms in relation to the exemptions of the material support bar that are very important, and we have discussed lengthily and thoroughly how this thing can be done, how decisions can be decentralized, delegations of authorities can be done, and lots of other things in order to try to avoid the collateral damage of these security measures that we understand. I mean, countries have the right to have their own security policies and to protect the countries, but to avoid the collateral damage of this in asylum in general and in resettlement in particular.
Great. Well, let's take another round of questions. I have two up in the front here. Roberta?
Roberta Cohen, Brookings Institution. I was one of the founders of the Brookings Project on Internal Displacement. And as you know, we advocated over the years for UNHCR's leadership when it comes to the protection of internally displaced persons. I wonder if you could comment on the successes and also the challenges that UNHCR has faced in playing a greater role, which it does, in the protection of IDPs, and whether you could also comment, we had always advocated for greater attention to conflict IDPs. Now there are protection problems for disaster IDPs. And we wonder to what extent UNHCR is playing a role in the protection of displaced persons in natural disasters, the sudden onset natural disasters.
Great. And we have right here in the second row.
Hi, Kate Phillips, Brasso with the International Rescue Committee. Wanted to move on to another situation in the Middle East, one that has sort of been overshadowed a little bit by everything going on there at the moment, that of Iraqi refugees, which is one of the largest refugee crises in the world. And you had called for a comprehensive plan to be put together in January, both to deal with the situation regionally and internally in Iraq. And in a year that the U.S. is set to leave Iraq, and when we're worried about a lot of the attention being turned away, I'd like to hear a little bit about where you think that situation is in terms of it being resolved and not turning into another one of these protracted refugee crises. And in addition to that, we didn't mention all of the conflict going on in Syria in the moment and all of the disturbing stories that have been coming out this week, considering double displacement, as you called it before, and the fact that Syria is the largest refugee-hosting country for Iraqi refugees, how you see the turbulence going on there at the moment causing another displacement crisis for those Iraqi refugees who already had to flee a few years ago.
Okay, and let's take one more, just a few rows behind.
Thank you. Ariana Rabindranath with Asia Society in Washington, D.C. Could you please address some of the unique challenges faced by women and children, refugees, and IDPs, and also perhaps some of the progresses made recently in their protection? Thank you.
Excellent. IDPs, Iraq, Syria, women?
Conflict, internal displacement is something that now, is fully assumed by UNHCR it is our obligation to do everything to ensure the coordination of the so-called protection cluster in the context of the humanitarian reform in relation to conflict, internal displaced. So, we have no doubts at all in relation to our commitment. But when one looks at results, I think one needs to be realistic. And I think the results are mixed. We have worked together very well with Walter Kellin. I think Walter Kellin played a very important role in relation to making things move in several countries by his active diplomacy. And that was extremely important, because in the end, if the state doesn't do or allow protection to be done, not much can be done. As you know, there is no longer a special representative of the Secretary General for internally displaced. There is now a rapporteur of the Human Rights Council, and I believe that this downgrading of the function will represent a loss in relation to the capacity to have an influence, even if the person chosen is a very good one. I have no doubt about it. On the other hand, I've been feeling... And probably this has to do with the changes of power relations in today's world. I've lived a bipolar world. I've lived a unipolar world. I'm living now in a confusing world that is no longer unipolar, but it's not yet multipolar. And sometimes we get the impression that nobody is in charge in some areas. And, of course, impunity becomes... That is why also so important. What's happening now in Libya is so important, because, it's clear that dictators are not allowed to do everything, and sometimes it's good that to have an example to show that. But there has been in the recent 2 years a trend for dictators to feel that they could do whatever, that impunity was. And I've seen the human rights agenda losing ground to the national sovereignty agenda, clearly, and that was a very strong limitation in the capacity to deliver protection in many of the situations in which we were involved in internal displacement. I think we have refined our methodologies. I think we have refined the capacity of coordination. We have improved the capacity of the different actors, NGOs and others, to the cooperation with the ICRC has been extremely important, but... even with all those improvements, I think it's important to recognize that we are far from ensuring that internally displaced by conflict get adequate protection. For instance, to give an example, we have now massively increased our presence in Eastern DRC, with the support of the US, by the way. And we are starting to see results in relation, namely, to sexual and gender-based violence, which is linked to the third question, in the Eastern DRC. But it's a very slow process, and to be honest, the results are far from what I would like to see. Natural disasters. We are in very active discussions with our membership in order to have an agreement for UNHCR to assume a predictable role in the coordination of the protection cluster in natural disasters at country level. There were a few countries opposing that, namely the US was very reluctant in relation to that. I think we have overcome the opposition of most of the donor countries. We still have the opposition of a certain number of countries in the south, like Bangladesh or Lebanon, to give just a few examples. I hope that in the June Standing Committee this will be finally overcome and that UNHCR will be able to have a predictable role in the protection cluster in natural disasters, which until now was not possible. There is full agreement in the context of the interagency mechanisms for that to be done. There are still some resistance from member states. We hope to overcome them in the short term. Iraq. We were convinced some time ago that we were making important progress. With the new government in Iraq, the dialogue has improved, and we believe that for the first time we see progress in the way to address the need to be effective in return and support to returnees, both from the outside and from the inside, even if there is a long way to go. But there were several positive things happened, the Dial Initiative. For the first time, there was a recognition of the dramatic situation of about 500,000 displaced inside Iraq in abject circumstances, and the need to address this as a priority from not only our point of view, but from the government point of view, the admission, I mean, between admission and action. But I saw some progress being made. And the protection space in Syria and Jordan was guaranteed, and there was a return taking place. What we were witnessing is more and more, we have about 200,000 Iraqis registered with UNHCR in Syria and Jordan. More, but those that are registered for assistance, about 200,000. The number has been decreasing slowly, but we are witnessing a core of people very vulnerable that need support and for whom return is not so easy. So we were dealing with this idea that we were going to face a protracted situation of a group for which, of course, resettlement would be a very important element of solution, but then there would be that we would need a much stronger engagement of the Iraqi government in order to be able to address the problem of creating the conditions for a return of this residual group in difficulties. Now, the situation in Syria is a new element. We have not yet any information of a disturbance of our program of assistance to refugees in Syria. But, of course, one of the areas where there has been more opposition expressed is one of the areas around Damascus where our operation takes place. Until now it was not dramatically impacted, but, of course, there is a risk for the protection space in Syria that is quite obvious. A few Syrians crossed the border to Lebanon, but a few hundred in the recent days. We have not yet noticed a massive displacement of Iraqis, but I mean, it's obviously a big concern because we took for granted Syria as a protection space for Iraqis, and we would like that to remain independently of all the other aspects of the Syrian internal evolution. I think that one of the key concerns and developments of our action is in relation to what we call the Age, Gender and Diversity Project and its mainstreaming in the whole of our activities. The capacity to fully address the particular protection needs in relation to women and children has been growing, but we are still far from being there where I want us to be. The situation is particularly sensitive in relation to internal displacement. more than to refugee situations, but even in refugee situations, for a variety of reasons, lack of adequate security involvement, adequate assistance, cultural problems and dimensions in the communities. We still see a lot of discrimination against women and a lot of risks of women in relation to sexual and gender violence. And in relation to children, we still have a lot of concerns in several of our operations in relation to recruitment and to other aspects of violation of human rights of children that are particularly worrying. So this remains in the very center of our concerns. I think we are making progress. It's clearly our priority or one of our central priorities. But there is a long way to go. And it's not easy. I mean, there are a lot of resistance in the communities to make things happen. I mean, if you look at the Rohingya community, that is probably one of the most discriminated communities in the world. To be a woman in the context of the Rohingya community is to suffer a double discrimination, the discrimination that Rohingya suffer and then the discrimination women suffer within the community. So it's quite a tough thing, a tough nut to crack.
Well, we've been at this for about an hour, which is what we promised. We're a little behind schedule because we got started late, and I'm afraid we're going to have to wrap it up, and unfortunately I have to catch a plane, but maybe if you have additional time, people can talk to you on your way out. Please, as you can see from this discussion, we're very fortunate to have someone like Antonio Guterres in such an important position, and hats off to you, and all good wishes as you tackle these crises, and I think, please join me in thanking him for his remarks.
It's a privilege to be here. Thank you very much.